The Babylon Project was our last best hope to push for Lost Tales Volume 2. It failed. But in the year of the writer's strike, it became something greater. Our last best hope for fresh B5 content. The year is 2008. The name of the show is the Babylon Podcast. You know, I think I understand why all the listeners were really, really pushing us to get the season 3 intro. That just sounds sweet.
No. You know, and the real shame of it is that all the people who are just listening to the podcast, they don't get the really cool visual montage of Summer and the Star Fury and Jeffrey practicing his glide. And, you know, that's kind of a shame. But you know, it's an audio format here, so.
Hey, that could be coming. You never know.
Yeah. You never know, eventually. But I am Summer Brooks. How are you today?
I'm Tim Callender. I'm doing quite well, thank you.
Thanks for asking. It's Jeffrey, living once again here in the land of Hillary Wood, apparently.
Oh, man.
Well, Hillary, she did well
would,
here.
Would she?
Will she? There's the question. Yeah, it's we're recording this the day after Super Tuesday, and I'm recovering.
And I'm Michael, the system op.
We just like to call him Data.
Yeah.
Wrong franchise.
Wrong universe.
I'm sorry. I had this Shatner Nimoy show in my head there. I was watching. Yeah, exactly.
Yes, the mind melting, I am told, is on Netflix, so you're good.
Netflix, okay. Yes. Well, there you go. I'm watching it on HDNet right now. It's fascinating. It's like totally visually boring, but it's just great to listen to their stories.
Excellent.
Hey, I just got my Apple TV, so I've actually canceled my Netflix for the first time in 15 years. I shut my Netflix down.
You got rid of Netflix?
I don't need it. Not with iTunes.
We need your 22,000 movie reviews, though.
Well, that's true. They're still there.
Are they?
Oh, yeah, they're still on there. Yeah, it blew me away.
Whole new world for you, huh?
It really is. Mm-hmm. It really
Golly,
is. It's amazing.
Mike. The next thing we know, Mike is going to start growing hair on his head again.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? To be able to sit down.
Actually, it'll be eye hair.
I have eye hair. I haven't shaved my eyebrows off yet. But I'll tell you what, the coolest thing that you will do in probably this year is to pick up an Apple TV and sit down and watch and listen Babylon Podcast on your TV. It is just really cool.
Wow.
Does the sound quality through your audio system sound a lot different?
Oh, it's awesome.
Wow.
I am such a good engineer.
No. How do you really feel? Don't hold back. You're amongst friends.
Hey, since we're talking about digital media, why don't Summer, you make the big announcement about Farpoint Media's digital presence.
Farpoint Media has a castle inside of Second Life.
And it's cool. And it's got a really big mixer board in it.
It's got a huge recording studio with an open studio around it so people can gather in and watch us virtually record. I think eventually we're going to be piping the live feed through that.
We will be sending the live feed in on that on our record days when we're doing this show. And that should be happening fairly soon. I think everything's in place to do it. We just need to get one little piece together and that can be happening.
So, yeah. So if hanging out in the chat room and watching tech scroll by is not your cup of tea, just hop into Second Life and hang out in the castle and listen to the live feed, chat to other avatars that are in there. And, and yes, I have an avatar in there. Michael has an avatar in there. We're going to get Jeffrey an avatar. I don't know how we're going to put a Vorlon skin on it, but...
I bet we can do it.
I think we can.
Oh, you bet.
So I bet
the Vorlon has always been there.
It's going to be one of those nights, isn't it?
Yes.
So for those of us who are cyberly challenged, tell us just a little bit more about what it is that this is.
Second Life is an, I guess, what would you call it? An alternative online world?
It's called a 3D chat room is what it is.
It's a virtual world. Secondlife.com?
Yes. It's more than that, because I know TD0013, our beloved Stormtrooper, has a store in there where people actually buy different point of view swag through Second Life.
Yes, and we'll have a lot of that as well. We're going to have T-shirts and a lot of different things that you'll be able to buy inside of Second Life. That's going to be really cool.
Posters
possibly. Cool. I don't know. We'll see what we can build. Whatever we can come up with.
Babylon Park video?
It could be.
Hey, we might be able to do that too.
All right. Okay, so far...
What else you got in the storage locker, Jeffrey?
I got enough hair in there to make both of you look really good.
I always wanted to be Chewbacca for Halloween.
Okay, so you go to secondcity.com and you'll somehow find
Second Life. You're going to find Rick Moranis.
Secondlife.com. You go and you sign up for an avatar if you don't already have one.
And that's all free?
Yes, that's all free. And then you download the program where that's the environment. So when you launch that program, you log into that and poof, you're in there. Kind of like Evercrack and World of Warcraft.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
But it's not quite like Tron, Jeffrey, so you don't have to worry about that part of it.
Well, there's a lot of that in there too, but.
All right.
Okay. I think I get it.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I'm. One, me and my avatar. Once we're in there, we're going to find other avatars bumping into each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to say, gee, Summer, don't you look great today? And you'll reply back, can't touch this or something like that.
No, I thought the cryptic answers was your deal.
There's nothing cryptic about can't touch this. I think I know exactly where that's coming from. But you're saying that while you're in there looking at the avatars, you're going to be able to hear the live feed.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And you can actually talk, and actually there's audio cues that you can do back and forth.
Because
I think Brian earlier was like having your character laugh, and you could hear it laughing through the speakers. It was kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the live feed will only be on when the live feed's on. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's not like we're going to be streaming audio in there 24/7, but... when we're actually doing something, when we're doing a show or the studio's live, we'll have it on in there.
Stop Very by nice. The Farpoint Castle on Second Life so you can hear Mike's bird sing.
Yeah. Oh, I got to get Buddy an avatar.
Oh, man.
You see, I do serve a purpose.
Absolutely. That is Buddy, for those who don't know, and probably most of you don't, is the single most obnoxious critter ever on the planet. That not only will it just annoy you beyond reason, but just downright piss you off in the process. Too.
She's not that bad. She just wants to be a podcaster. She wants to be a birdcaster.
A birdcaster.
I'm going to give her own show.
No, totally. That would be funny.
That's a great idea.
That'd be the best thing we have on the network right now. That'd be good.
For those out there who know anything about Second Life, it is available for Mac and Windows. I don't know about Linux. I can ask if you care. I don't know. Somebody had to have made it. And no, there's emulators out there.
I don't know. We'll see.
Oh, well.
That's up to them to figure out.
I don't even want to know what that was.
Tonight's show is brought to you by Coralejo.
There we go. That's what I knew. I knew. That's kind of sad, but I knew.
Must be a new bottle, huh?
There's a few miles on it now.
That's it for our Second Life pimpage. Also, if anybody wants to hear me read a fantasy story, the latest.
Is it my fantasy?
Go ahead, Jeffrey.
No.
Go ahead, Jeffrey.
Please have your credit cards ready and call 1-800-1900 babe.
Right. No, starshipsofa.com posts short stories by authors, science fiction, some old, some not quite so old, but I read Going Through Changes by Nebula Award-winning author Pat Murphy, and that episode went up today.
Very nice.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun recording that. I want to do more reading. So starshipsofa.com. Go tell Tony I said hi.
Hi, Tony.
But we will take a quick break and come back with some excellent deep geeking.
Yeah.
Beneath the streets of San Francisco, they are waiting, hoping you stay out a bit too late to drink a bit too much and stumble home alone. If fortune smiles upon you, they kill you where you stand. But if you're unlucky, they drag you down into the tunnels to meet their queen. Nocturnal is a free podcast-only audiobook from Scott Sigler, the creator of the sci-fi thriller Earthcore and the number one best-selling horror novel, Ancestor. Go ahead, get your scare on at scottsigler.net. And look for Scott's major hardcover release, Infected, available from Crown Publishing, April 1st, 2008.
Digging down to the most obscure facts in fandom, this is
Deep Geeking Season 3 style. I like that.
Yeah, I do too.
I like that.
Freshen it all up.
I like this whole fantasy thing of yours, though, Summer, that you're talking about here.
I can work on that.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Let's do a fantasy deep geeking tonight.
I've been saying for years that Summer needs a 900 number, and we just all our money problems would be solved.
Oh, you're not Summer. You're not on Skype right now.
Yeah, I am.
Do you see my message?
I do now.
Ah.
I'm ignoring it.
Okay, mind bleach.
Oh Lord.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Really, I do.
No, come on, read it. You could do it. Do us your best fantasy.
I'm not reading that out loud.
Come on.
No.
You could do it. Come on.
The listenership will double, Summer.
Exactly. No. Come on. Sex sells. Come on. Do your best fantasy.
I will do it outside the recording. I will not do it here. So there. So the live feed people will get a treat, but I'm no.
Of course, that means that the live feed archive is going to get land with a million.
Yeah, exactly.
Crash.
That's okay.
Exactly.
That's all right.
To hear Summer read this, please dial 1-900.
But there's a very special reason why we've kept you around for this deep geek, and you are integral to this episode.
If I may, in preparation for this evening, and the fact that it was quite a long time ago, I did some quick research here and immediately was reminded. I see this here. I think I found this on a little synopsis that was available for the DVD, third season DVD, on Amazon. Interludes and Examinations presented the death of a major supporting character. Yes! That's what I'm talking about. I want new business cards. Major supporting character. Jeez, I should have been paid more. I should have been paid a lot more for that.
You could amend it to say dead major supporting character.
Well, it's sure, that's what it says here. The death of
Your business card.
Yes.
Yeah, but I came back.
Well, it's true you did.
Just so I could die again.
Mm-hmm.
Again. Once you're good at it, you know, it's like being pigeonholed in this industry. I'm telling you. Whatever.
We need someone to play a major supporting character who dies.
He's being typecast as the dying alien.
You need an alien to die in your movie? No problem. Get Willer. He'll exactly. take care of it.
Give me that guy who was in that outfit.
Yes, but Interludes and Examinations was, I thought it was going to be a change of pace because it's Interludes and Examinations. When I saw the title coming up, I'm like, okay, we're going to get a slight breather, but no.
And that's the thing. I think even JMS mentions on the Lurker's Guide that was part of the intention behind the title of the episode, was to lull people into a false sense of security isn't the right word, but you know what I'm trying to say. Just like you say, it's going to be a breather. You know, Ship of Tears was kind of intense. You know, it ratchets up the tension a little bit. And we, you know, business with Jakar and Delenn, and of course Bester showing up, and actually does start off fairly quietly. You know, maybe not in a relaxed way, but we get Ivanova giving her log as a voiceover over visuals of an obviously newly hired security guard, because she comments that they've had to step up security and they can't do background checks as well as they would like, so they know there are going to be some lapses. And sure enough, one of the lapses we see is one of the security guards having a meeting with one Mr. Morden.
That guy, he always just pops up at the most inopportune moment, doing the most dastardly things.
Oh, and he is just really slimy in this particular episode.
Yes.
Ivanova makes mention that no one's seen Kosh for over a week, and when the Vorlon goes to ground, she's
start
worried.
To worry, yes.
Yes. Especially since now the shadows are on the move in the open.
The plight of Sheridan trying to convince the Gaim to help the Bracari. They're like, no.
Yeah, I know. That's what I liked. It wasn't even couched in anything diplomatic to say, you know, we have issues of our own on our Sector 14 frontier or whatever. It's just like, will you help? No.
Like, no, they haven't attacked us yet. They haven't noticed us yet. Bye-bye.
Right. And the other thing that I loved was where the Gaim ambassador tells Sheridan, do you have equal ability? Because if you can show equal ability, we'll be happy to join on. In other
equal
words,
power,
bandwagoners.
Yes. Right, yeah, equal power.
You know, it's not like United, we can stand up to this. It's like, we just want to make sure we're on the winning side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, if you have as much firepower as they do, okay, then maybe we'll think about it. Not even we'll think
right.
about it.
Yeah, it's Sheridan. I mean, he is just obviously frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, what else do we have going? Well, we've got a couple other B stories, if you will, but let's pursue those here after we take care of Sheridan trying to figure out what he can do to,
okay.
Because those all, you know, it'll be easier, I think, to dissect those, because while in a sense they all intersect, they touch on each other, they don't really have much bearing one on the other. You know what I'm saying? I think we can deal with them in a separate manner. So we'll continue forward. Sheridan is beside himself trying to figure out what to do. The shadows are not displaying any logical pattern to their attacks. They, as he notes, talking with Delenn in the war room, they come in, blow the place up, and then leave.
Mm-hmm.
His comment is they don't even bother to secure the area.
Yeah, and that's frustrating, because you can't. He's a military guy. He's used to military objectives in these type of battles, you know, seeing the pattern of the, you know, it's like, okay, what are they doing? This is their objective. We can plan against that. But if they just come in, blow something up, and leave, and not even in contiguous areas, they're just randomly hitting different spots all over the place. Literally, all they're doing is stirring up chaos. And he can't wrap his mind around that. His training, he hasn't broken out of that to where he can go, okay, we're going to have to approach this differently. Right now, he's just, dude, what is this?
Right. Right. And as he knows, he's talking with Delenn, you know, all the various races who were fighting each other or you know, were in league with the shadows, and they're all weakened now, so none of them can mount a defense. He says, I think he comments, you know, it's almost like that's their plan, is just to divide and conquer. But they're not even conquering. They're just coming in and destroying things. And as he's trying to figure it out, Delenn reaches over and very gently touches him and says, you know, I'm sure you'll think of something. And he walks out, and then he comments like, oh, you know, now everybody's talking like a Vorlon. And then it dawns on him.
Yeah.
So then he goes to talk to our good Ambassador Kosh. And at first he's just making the pitch. You know, he's being the diplomat. The shadows are coming in. They're hitting everybody hard. But I can't get anybody to unite. If the Vorlons would just throw their weight in, if you guys could just come up with one victory, then we could be united. We could bring the League of Non-Aligned Worlds in, the Narn, and we can fight this war. And Kosh just says no and keeps going. And then that's when Sheridan, he just snaps.
I think that was it was a major supporting role, actually, is what it was.
What, Bruce Boxleitner in that? I agree. I think he did a great job backing you up as the Morlon. Now, let me ask you something, Jeffrey. In that, as we know in television, you know, you shoot a scene, so you've got the camera set up for, say, the close-up of Boxleitner shooting over Kosh's shoulder or whatever, so you run that, you shoot that, then you move the camera around and shoot that, and do all that. So were you in the suit the entire time, or did you get the chance to take a break and take the helmet off?
Tim, I always took the helmet off every chance that I could. Maybe not all I could. I wish I could show you. I'm sitting here trying to illustrate, but I it's radio, which is a good thing because I have a face for radio. There was a way to disconnect. Or the very back of the helmet had a little hinge on it, and that's what kept it really tight to my head. But once I could pop that hinge, I had a little more room that I could at least take it off of my face and rest it up on my forehead so I could get some fresh air. That was like the most important thing for me, was just because I simply just couldn't breathe inside the fiberglass helmet. And when your head can't breathe, the heat in your body just can't go anywhere. And it was just, you know, that was the brutal part. So I was constantly popping the head up just enough to get air in. But what I recall most about that brawl in the hall day, which I remember making posters, boxing posters.
No way.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is another thing, Summer, that's buried in the archive somewhere. I can show you some of my brawl in the hall posters.
Oh, yeah.
That I did. And I hung them up all around the hallways of the stages, you know, promoting this big fight that was going to happen on a certain right. day, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And it was called the Brawl in the Hall. And what I remember after all the drama leading up to that particular day is the day of shooting. Oh, and I don't remember exactly, but I had something like 102 degree fever that day. I was very sick and should not have even been at work, but I wasn't going to miss this opportunity. So I remember climbing into the suit and staying in it for most all of the time because I didn't have the energy to get in and out and in and out. So they just kept a director's chair nearby, because it's sort of funny, Kosh could actually sit in a director's chair. It was just like the right height. I could get my big ass over there and set it down and take the weight off and just relax a little bit, but I wouldn't physically get out of the suit. And I remember being pretty delirious through all of that and not having a lot of energy, but boy, oh boy, was that fun to do, because Boxleitner was so on his game, and he was so there, and he and I really got pumped up to do the scenes. We would literally yell and scream at each other and push each other around.
Wow.
That's the footage that never was captured. I mean, we were like two boys playing rough. I remember, you know, we really pushed each other around, got all hyped up, and then they'd say, okay, roll it. And he would, you know, just tear me a new one with the language that he was so angry and pumped up, and it really worked out great. And that allowed me to come around on him when I did my, force field, energy field,
yeah,
whatever it was,
you know, trick.
Yeah, exactly. And threw him against the wall. That all worked out, you know, really well. And it was because we were getting so amped up for it. As I recall, Bruce will probably tell me it was the worst acting of his life, but, or whatever, but it was, in fact, I have this great photo. That's another thing, Summer, you'll have to see. I have this great photo of Bruce and I in that scene where I've got him pinned against the wall there, and he signed it for me, and it says, Uncle, I quit.
But of course, as we know in the episode, he doesn't quit, and that's one of the, you know, even watching it again after having seen it a dozen times, there's still that tension there, because you know he's playing with fire, and he knows it.
Mm-hmm.
Sheridan does.
Yeah, I mean, it's very poignant, his sentiments. Go ahead and kill me, because if we don't survive this war, I'm not going to live. My own government wants to kill me. I got nothing less to lose. Bring it on.
Right. Yeah. And the one-liners getting tossed back and forth, impotent, up yours.
Right, right. That was very cool. But that, you know, that leads to the, he also says that too, doesn't he? Isn't that when Kosh says that if you go to Zahad, No. I won't be there to help you
when you go to Zaha Dam. Yes.
Right.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And he says, well, and that's, you know, Sheridan says, well, okay, if that's the price, you withhold your help. And Kosh looks at him and goes, you don't understand, but you will.
You will. Mm. Yeah.
And then walks away. And then, of course, we find out exactly what Kosh meant by that, because our good friend Mr. Morden shows up at Kosh's doorstep.
Kind of a
Actually, we're jumping ahead.
Ahead a little bit, but yes, the
Vorlons do come to the battle, as it were. And I thought that was interesting, because here comes just at the right moment, Delenn shows up at the war room with representatives from the League of the Non-Aligned World. There's the Game Ambassador, and there's the Brakiri Ambassador, and a handful of others. And that's when they get reports about Shadows being engaged by the Vorlons, and the Vorlons winning.
Mm-hmm.
And we get those are some really cool battle shots, too.
Yes, they are.
You know, the one shot, it's like a head-on shot of a battle crab spewing out all the little fighters.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's just crazy.
Yeah, as it spins and turns away from the camera, it's just spinning out, and the little fighters are just pouring out towards you. You're like, oh, that's a cool shot.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you have to believe that Kosh told Delenn that they were going to intervene, because there's no way she would have known that they would have picked that battle to subvert, to intervene in, unless
right.
he said, okay, you know, basically, well, he would have said it very Kosh-like, but he would have said, I'm going to do as Sheridan wishes, the next attack we will do something about. And sure enough, the attack starts, and a few minutes later, Delenn walks in with all the ambassadors, and then Ivanova says, wait, we got Vorlons.
Yeah. Who's winning? We are. Yay for our side. But, you know, in true Straczynski fashion. And actually, really, when you think about it, in all the great epic tales, you don't get something for nothing. There's always a sacrifice that needs to be made. And we get shots of Sheridan heading off to bed in his quarters, and the voiceover with him and Ivanova, and he says, well, you know, I really should go see Kosh and say thanks. And she says, well, it's 2 a.m., you're exhausted, go get some sleep. And her comment is, my grandfather said, good news can wait. Bad news won't go away.
Mm-hmm.
And what do we get for the visual? Now we get Morden showing up at Kosh's doorstep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it's more appropriate to realize that Morden's kind of miffed when he gets a message that the Vorlons have interfered. I mean, you actually see a very, very dark, concerned look on his face. Like,
yeah.
He wasn't expecting that.
Right, right. Well, as we find out later, they've violated the rules.
Mm-hmm.
They have broken the rules of the game that the two sides had established so many aeons ago. Well, I think Morden in this episode is really put out in so many ways, but we'll get to that in a sec. Because one of the things that struck me this time around watching is that Morden basically jimmies the lock for the Shadows.
Mm-hmm.
So that made me wonder about how effectual the Shadows are able to, in other words, are they there by proxy? You know, do they not engage in the physical nature of things because that will give away their presence? That was something that wasn't, I mean, I'm not saying that it was unclear. It was just an interesting.
I just saw it as that they have a physical presence. They are physical. They just have little personal cloaking devices. So they, you know, they actually
sure, but why
don't
would they need Morden to? Why would they need Morden to force the door?
Because they didn't have that. They didn't have pockets to carry those little chip things that we had to slide through to open them.
Have you seen them? They don't have prehensile. They don't have opposable thumbs. How are they going to get in the room? It's not like they can. They might have been able to blast it open, but that might have required too much energy, and that would have given the presence away.
I guess, but they kind of gave their presence away anyways once they killed Kosh.
Well, but nobody knows how they got in or how they killed Kosh. If they had done something beforehand, but before the battle, that might have been enough warning to get help there, and they would have been seen.
Yeah, but, you know, here's the other part of it, and I'm trying to remember exactly what Trevellis wrote about it in the Technomage trilogy because the events sort of overlap. But one of the things that I've always thought was that Kosh didn't put up a fight. Now, whether or not, you know, Morden had to bribe somebody to get a security clearance card to open the door is almost irrelevant. You know, I really get the sense, because as he tells, he's almost like he's the sacrificial lamb.
Hmm, okay,
you know, by violating the rules, this is how he is attempting to, what's the word I want?
He's trying to take responsibility, right. He's trying to take responsibility for what he did and right. bring things back into level playing field.
Right, because once he agrees to Sheridan's proposal, all right, we'll help you. He knows exactly what that means. You know, I mean, that's one the thing that's driving that comment. Yeah, you know, I'm not going to be there for you when you go to Zahadum. Yeah, you said that, if withholding your help. No, you don't get it. So Kosh knew full well what
the sacrifice.
Yeah, exactly. And he says as much when, you know, when he's appears as David Sheridan in mm-hmm. John's
in the dreams. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Do you think Morden used like the old Saturday Night Live Land Shark skit to open the door?
I think he had a bobby pin.
No. Yeah, I think he was doing the old, you know, the old Thomas Magnum thing. Work the lock. Don't look at the dogs. Work the lock. You look at the dogs.
Eat pizza.
No. But yeah, so we have
Andygram.
We have Andygram. Unfortunately, we have a
I'm
dead
not a shark,
warlock.
I'm a dolphin.
Yeah. Yeah, so what do you think about the dream sequence?
What did I think of it?
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was wonderful in that Sheridan quite didn't. I mean, at first he's responding to it like it's a dream. You know, here's his father who's saying weird cryptic things. But at some point, I think he understands at the dream level what it means. And I liked that Kosh appears as Sheridan's father because that carries a lot of resonance. Mm-hmm. Not only do we know that, you know, Sheridan has a very close relationship with his father, but that also indicates how Kosh really viewed that relationship
yes.
between he and Sheridan. You know, that casts it in a whole different light. I love the comment where he says, when you live as long as I have, you kind of get used to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that kind of turns a cliche on its side. You know, I've lived a long life. Don't feel bad for me. You know, it's like, no, I've lived a long life, and I kind of like being alive.
Yeah, I kind of want to keep living a longer life.
That's right.
But wait, yeah. Let me just, because I haven't seen this in a while. Didn't the dream happen just, it happens right before you see the death of Kosh?
It happens the dream. Yeah, the dream is happening yeah. while he's
it
being
was concurrent.
Attacked. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So you know that the attack is happening, and
yes.
then you see the dream unfolding? Okay.
Yes.
All right.
They're
yeah,
happening.
Well, it's cross cuts back and forth. You get shots
right,
of
right.
of shadowy figures and weird lights and Morden looking on, and then you know, it's a jump cut back to Sheridan talking with his father.
Right.
You know,
right.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's very plain exactly what's going on. But, you know, Kosh very much says, you know, go ahead.
What are you. Relative to the father, and it was a pleasure to meet Rance Howard. It was very cool. He was a very, very nice gentleman. Was that indeed like Fall of Night 422? When everybody sees Kosh in their own way, was that Kosh portraying himself as the father?
Yes. Yeah. He's
yeah.
projecting himself into Sheridan's mind.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Just want to make sure we were on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
There.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because it actually threw me off the first time, the very first time I saw it, I was like, he's dreaming? Oh, okay, I get it.
Yeah, right.
And
yeah.
that really sunk in going, wow, okay. You never saw this side of Kosh
personal.
Until he was, yeah, you never saw this side of Kosh until he was dying, basically.
Yeah, mm-hmm. right. And don't feel bad for me. Don't blame yourself for what happens. You know, so you want to talk about maybe laying a guilt trip unintentionally. and then there's, you know, there's an energy spike that's detected at CNC, and then that wash of energy. Well, there's that shot of, it almost looks like a blowtorch. You know, it's reflected in Morden's face mask, and I'm guessing that's where Kosh's his countersuit is cracked open, and
mm-hmm.
eventually dies, and the energy comes washing across the station, which is a really cool effect. And Sheridan sits up, bolt upright in bed, gasping, Kosh, and then there's that moment when it sinks in and he knows and he repeats the name again, but it's so poignant.
Yeah.
You know, because he knows exactly what's transpired.
Yeah, because during the dream, he's acting like he's just having a dream about his dad, and then he wakes up suddenly, and he knows exactly what's happened. He knows.
Right. Yeah. And then the scene in Sheridan's office with Garibaldi and Delenn, and they're looking at the crushed helmet.
So I got to ask Timmy, did you cry?
You know what? The first time I saw it, I'm sure I did.
It
still gets
me
misty every time, though.
You're
a because it is. It is the death of a major supporting character.
That's my point.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But it's moving because there's Sheridan. He says nothing in the entire scene.
Mm-hmm.
Delenn comments that the Vorlons know about it, and fortunately, because Kosh will disappear for months on end, his presence won't be noticed. Lack of his presence won't be noticed. They'll send a replacement. And they ask that they put all Kosh's personal effects into a ship.
And the ship will go off on its own. It will grieve in its own way.
Yes.
And since Kosh is no longer alive, it too will... I got the impression that it was just going to fly into the sun.
Yeah.
Into the star. So
yeah. Very, very Viking-like.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Right. Exactly.
Yes. I had one tiny problem with that scene in Sheridan's office. Delenn is harping about how they have to keep it quiet. And the very first thing that Garibaldi says, I have my people going over that room with a fine tooth comb. All right. How are you going to keep all of them quiet?
Yeah, well, I don't think, you can't.
That's
you
the
can't,
one
but...
I had with the episode. I'm like, you do it. You and one other person who you can just slap a lip cuff on or something, you don't have a whole team of people. Cause some of them are going to go, dude, we were cleaning up the rest of Kosh's outfit. He's like toast. There's scorch marks all over the place. And that gets across the station in about 5 seconds.
Yeah. But on the other hand, all right, I'll maybe quibble with that a little bit. How many people are going to actually believe that Kosh is dead? He's a Vorlon. Okay,
yeah,
you
true.
Were in the Vorlon's quarters. Yeah, right. No, really. Oh, dude, really, I was. Yeah, right. Here, you have another drink. No, I swear. It's all tore up. It's like a war in there. Yeah.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think everybody pretty much knew that was pretty real when that happened. there couldn't have been a... I'm not buying that.
Yeah, I know. And I agree with Summer's point. I think that's just Delenn being Delenn.
I give you credit for even catching that. I didn't.
Yeah, it never occurred to me either.
That's why you guys host this show.
It's a little, every now and then a little story thing will, happen and I'll just go, huh? What was I?
Well, I was just looking up real quick to see if I could find the dialogue between Kosh and Sheridan, and I did on TV.com, where they happened to rate this episode a 9.6, mm-hmm. superb,
mm-hmm. Yes.
Which is pretty high. And they would have gotten a full 10 if it weren't for that fact, Summer.
Really?
I'm sure. Yeah. It says right here
That's
online.
That's my point exactly. Yeah, sure, right. You were in the Vorlon's quarters.
Yeah.
He couldn't really be dead.
It is a superb episode because that's not the only part of what's going on in terms of interludes and examination.
Oh, no.
No, not at all.
Oh, no, because we also get... Let's deal with Stephen Franklin.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. That was the story that was really tearing me up until the point that I realized what was happening. Because the STEM thing started...
A while,
like two or three episodes. Yeah, exactly.
No, like a year, like in the first season almost. No, second right. season, early second season.
Well, he comments on there was the doctor down below with the alien healing device, who's played by June Lockhart, and I'm sorry I can't remember the character's name. That was so long ago. But there was mention of something to do with STEMs at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Not from Franklin's end, but just, there was a comment about, this doctor lost her
license because
of STEMs use. Yeah, mm-hmm. right.
Right.
But the first time we saw, what was it? We it's actually funny because he talks to his mentor in, what was it, Hunter Prey? You know, where he's like, you know, hey, you got to take it easy on this. Yeah, you have to take it easy on the stems. And I just thought it was funny that he's telling his mentor, you know, you can't use stems. And he's like, I got to stay awake or else they'll catch me. And then later we see Franklin pressured into a similar situation by, you know, his workload and his personal commitment to helping. And he's using stems to stay awake more and more and more and more and more.
So there's that great scene in Med Lab where he's arguing with Dr. Hobbs about how to deal with a patient and who's got some respiratory trauma going on, and they're in danger of losing him, and in rolls Garibaldi with one of his guys on a stretcher who's got into a fight and all this stuff going on, and the patient starts to die, and Franklin basically wigs out, yelling at everybody, and, you know, and one of those uncomfortable silences. They're standing there, and, you know, Franklin says, okay, Michael, I know he's one of yours. We'll take care of him. And, all right, let's, you know, at least we saved the patient. Dr. Hobbs, his assistant, I should say assistant, the other doctor's like, well, you know, Dr. Franklin, you told the intern the wrong information. It's like, no, I didn't. It's like, well, do you want to pull the record tapes on that? Franklin, of course, well, you do what you got to do. Nah. And later on, Garibaldi confronts Franklin about this, and Franklin says, well, you know, I was under stress, you know, I was very tense, and they said, no, you weren't tense. You were about to have a meltdown.
Yeah.
And confronts him and says, hey, look, this is the stims, I can help. And, of course, Franklin says, no, you've been lying to me about the stims, leave me alone.
Yeah, he's...
You know, just get out of my face.
Yeah.
And yeah. Yeah, Garibaldi says, okay, look. I got to do what I got to do. Just remember, I came to you first.
Yeah. Right. Now that turned out to be, because I think ultimately, Walkabout turned out to be like one of my real faves.
Oh. Yeah.
And this was setting it all up.
Yeah. And here's one of the things, because again, amongst everything else that sets Babylon 5 head and shoulders above science fiction television that had come before it, and I think set the bar for what has come after it. We're dealing with real people with real issues. You know, I mean, you got all the fantastic fighting ancient shadows, the you know, every 1,000 years this eternal battle is waged and across the galaxy and so forth, so on. But then you've got this real personal story of this guy who just, he gets sucked into it, as he tells Garibaldi later on, you know, when Garibaldi is about to tap the computer records to see what Franklin's blood test results were. That's one of the things that Franklin says. He says, you know, I just, in essence, he says, I just cared too much.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't do it without the stims, and then it was eating me up.
Yeah. And what I like about the story is it's not something that just happened in two episodes and he got over it in two episodes.
It took
this is like a season and a half building up to where, he's got a problem. And it takes literally the rest of the season for him to deal with what, you know, his life, what he's done.
Right.
And try to overcome it.
And it plays out even further than that when in the fifth season when Michael falls off the wagon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Franklin comes back around to him, you know, so are we okay? Anything going on here? And, of course, Garibaldi, oh, no, everything's fine. Oh. You know? So it's poignant. It's very human. And, you know, that scene where Garibaldi decides he's not going to check it. And, of course, he looks up, and there's Franklin standing in the doorway in the shadows, which is really great because it's just him silhouetted. It's like, why? Why didn't I? Or why, you know, why did I or why didn't I? It's like, why didn't you? It's like, well, because you know what? You had to know on some level what the deal was. And if you couldn't admit that, then it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're too far gone for me to help you at that point. And Franklin, you know, admits that he's got the problem. And what is he going to do about it? He calls Sheridan down to Med Lab and tenders his resignation. He just says, you know what, I have to relinquish the job before you take it away from me.
Mm-hmm.
And as he walks out, there's that great nonverbal from Sheridan. As he looks around, it's like, okay, you know, Kosh is dead. you know, what else is going on? You know, we're broken away from Earth. We don't have any help there. We're facing an ancient enemy. I got what I wanted, but it meant that my mentor has basically been killed, my Merlin, if you will. And now the doctor's just walked off the job.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, it just looked like what else can go wrong?
Yeah.
You know, so it's so even in the midst of that victory that will, you know, start to unite the League of the Non-Aligned Worlds, it's not necessarily a happy time, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just one step on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, it's misty, because here's the other bit of it to just add more trauma to everything. At the beginning of the episode, Londo is beside himself with joy, waiting for his beloved Adira to return.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Vera is happy for him because he's so happy. They're making arrangements for, you know, the largest suite on the station. And Vera's got a list of items that he needs to procure.
That's actually funny. And some personal items, this right here, I don't know, like, here, read that. And you go, oh.
Yeah, poor Veer. Well, just earlier than that, we should, because this is important. Londo, you know, he gets a call from Veer, says, okay, the suite's ready. You know, you want to check it out as I'm, you know, while I go gather up all the stuff that you gave me the list for. Londo heads that way, and of course, you know, an empty corridor, the lights turn red, and there's Morden at the other end, who says, Ambassador, we need to talk. And Morden tells Londo, well, you know, we had an agreement. It's like, well, yeah. And well, now Lord Reefa isn't returning my calls. The Centauri have pulled out their forces in areas where we had told them to go. Londo's, well, you know, word here, word there. And at this point, you know, Londo confronts Morden. And this was, I think, the first time we really see Morden put out. It's like, you guys can't do this. You know, you're supposed to be fighting this place where we need that, need you to be fighting. And Londo's, yeah, and why is that? I don't really think you have the interest of the Centauri Republic in mind. And, you know, we're not going to be your agents of chaos anymore.
And I like the way he said it, agents of chaos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Because you know Londo had to have started getting the reports about the attacks in Bracari space and other places. He's like, uh-huh. Yeah, you want us to help you out? Why?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. We're not really getting anything out of it. And you know, just, you know, Morden basically gets up in Londo's face and says, you're going to do this. All right. You know, we had an agreement. It's like, you know what? We had an agreement. The agreement was you do what you want to do in your part of the galaxy, and we do what we want in our part of the galaxy, and you know, leave us alone. And, of course, we hear the chattering of the shadows around, and this Londo walks off with the fateful line, there's nothing you can do to me that hasn't already been done.
Yes.
Oh, Londo, yes, Londo, Londo.
You'd think people in this universe, on this station at least, would learn not to say stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. Because as Morden tells his masters, no, or his associates, excuse me.
Yes.
No, we need him alive, and in their ways. And sure enough, after Veer's dropped off that list of items, he runs into Morden. Is there anything I can do? Short of dying? Nothing I can think of. Morden puts on one of his snake oil salesman acts and talks to the guy. He's like, I was supposed to meet Veer Kotto here. Oh, you just missed him. Well, maybe you can fill me in on what I missed. Oh. And sure enough, while they're waiting for the liner to dock at the station, carrying Adira, and Londo is beside himself with joy. He can't remember what it's like to be happy. And they realize, well, you know, all the passengers have come off, and they go into the docking corridor, and there's Dr. Hobbs with a body bag. Londo knows instantly who it is. Sure enough, it's Adira. And, you know, he's clutching at his hearts and sobbing. Tells her to check for poison. And then we get a scene in Londo's quarters where he's meeting with Mr. Morden.
Yes, and this always struck me as a little strange.
Yeah, go ahead. Tell me what your impressions are, because I get different vibes from it every time I watch it.
It's one of those things where my opinion on that scene has been tainted by an old, old document called The Unofficial Outtakes. It's a humorous, basically humorous outtakes, humorous takes on various scenes throughout seasons 1 through 4. And the one that parodies this scene is Londo is, "I want to talk to you about Adira's poisoning." And Morden goes, okay. And he goes, "I want you to get Reefa for me." He says, "Oh, okay. So me threatening you didn't kind of click in that I had something. Oh, I got away with that. Cool." Because you see him sitting there going, "Oh, really? You don't suspect me? Alrighty then. We'll just keep on going."
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like at the beginning of the scene, I get the sense that Londo knows that Morden is complicit.
Yeah, that's exactly. Report. It starts out right. Like he's about to confront Morden.
I think
on
you
it.
Know something about this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it shifts to Reefa did this. I want you to help me. I'm like, okay, you pulled that out of left field line down the foul line outside the stadium. How?
Yeah. When right. was the conflict with Lord Reefa?
Like a few episodes before.
Yeah. It is in...
It was third season, though, right? I mean, it wasn't carried over.
Yes,
yeah, okay.
Yes, it was third season.
Right. Okay, yeah, okay.
Yeah, in, Confessions of Light and Dark.
Okay.
Yeah, so, right, so I agree. And then he says, you know, "I want you to help me get Lord Reefa," and, you know, and Morden with the whole snake saying, "You know what? I think I heard Lord Reefa saying something about it, but it's about the time you told him to stop talking to me."
Mm-hmm.
"Maybe if I had been there..."
Yeah.
"I could have stopped him," and there's this expression on Londo's face. Again, every time I watch it, I can never quite tell whether he believes him or not.
Yeah.
Or maybe given what he asks of Morden,
yeah,
he doesn't care whether he believes him or not.
I don't think it's more of a... I think he wants to believe the convenient excuse. It's easier for him to strike back at Reefa than it is Morden, maybe.
And that could be. And also, I think maybe there's still... Because there's still the one thing he holds out when he says to Morden, you know, "All the people around me that I love die, and that's not going to happen anymore. I want you to help me get the people who did this to Adira. If you can guarantee that," and he says, "italics mine, guarantee the safety of my people, then you can do whatever you want. Let the galaxy burn." So even at that point, he still is that patriot, where he still wants to do things for the glory of the Republic. And I think you're right, Summer. Maybe he wants to believe what Morden's saying because he knows he's making a pact with the devil.
Mm-hmm.
And still is holding on to the fiction that he's doing this for the good of the Republic.
Yeah, I think Londo always knew exactly what was at risk. Always. Don't you? He always had a very clear understanding of what his responsibility was to the Centauri.
Well, I think once the fall of Narn, that's where I think he realized exactly what he'd done. I'm not sure early on. I'm not quite sure he knew what he was getting into, but I'll agree with you, Jeffrey. After a certain point, he knew what he was dealing with. And
we should remember also, whenever we have Ed Wasser on the show, we need to ask him if indeed Morden was really just his portrayal of a Hollywood agent. Because when I hear you guys talk about it, I'm like, oh, yeah, those guys are all over this town. Yeah.
Yeah, because Morden, he's just this one, it was as slimy as it comes.
Yeah, well, that's Hollywood agent.
You know? I'll have to take your word for that, Mr. Ward.
Hmm.
Yeah, so, he did look particularly sinister with his hair slicked back today. That time, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah. So it's just this episode is just full of emotion. Like you said at the beginning, Summer, you know, it's an innocuous title: Interludes and Examinations. I guess they're interludes, and they're certainly examinations. But wow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you sure wouldn't want to name the show "Death of a Major Supporting Role," right? That would just give it all away.
There you go. In a world at war, a major character dies.
When the first script read-throughs came through, what was that like for for all the cast and crew.
Well, I'll share this story with you. And it's possible I've told you this before, but the day that the first draft came out, and it wasn't even distributed widely. There was a draft that Joe would present to John Copeland, and John, I guess, would give his feedback, and that ultimately became the first draft of the script. And I'll never forget the day, because it was a day that after the shooting, most of the crew were going off to a local watering hole to celebrate the departure of one of our crewmen, a second AD named Doug Coring. And Doug was actually the guy that brought me to Babylon in the first place. Doug and I were childhood friends, and he got the gig on Babylon before I did, and he actually brought me in there. And that's, so I was indebted to Doug forever, and I remain that way. But Doug was leaving the show, and we all decided we were going out for drinks. And it was the end of the business day, and we were everybody was kind of getting ready and bailing out of the building as fast as possible and getting off to their liquid dinner. And I remember Copeland coming into my office with his copy of Joe's script and threw it on my desk. And in the most sinister Copeland-esque way, just said, "You're dead." And I was, "What?" And he walked out. So now I had to read this script. So now I'm late for the party. I'm right. Sitting there, you know, riveted as always, page by page by page, couldn't get enough. And then, like, when you read it, because as you guys were describing the intercut between, you know, the Sheridan's dream and the actual, well, it doesn't look that way on paper. It was just like someone took a sledgehammer and knocked my heart out of my body. I was stunned that Kosh was dead. I never saw that coming. And I was shaken. Visibly shaken. I was right. Really, really, really upset. And I had to go to this ha 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 party, you know, and I was just like, wow, drinking myself into the sewer, because I couldn't tell anybody because it wasn't officially distributed yet. So I couldn't say anything. And I was just like, man, you know, so I'll never forget what an impact that script had on me when I first saw it. Yeah, wow. That was quite a moment.
It is quite a script. It does sneak up. I don't, you know, I know at the time I didn't expect to see Kosh's death.
No, I can't imagine.
No, right. I don't think anybody expected.
No, but nobody did. Right. Exactly. Yeah. You just wouldn't have believed it. It was actually what might call the death of a major supporting character.
Right. But the thing is that on top of it all, it works so marvelously well. It doesn't feel gratuitous. You know, it doesn't feel like the major supporting character who got tired of being on the show in the fiberglass suit and wanted out, and they had to write him out. It didn't feel like tonight on Babylon, a very special Babylon 5, a major supporting character dies.
Right. No, no, no. You know, it was a tipping point.
Right, exactly.
It was a tipping point. It was no different than Ferdinand being killed that set off World War I. It was no different throughout history, we've had these tipping points, these events that happen that all of a sudden go, ugh, there you go.
Right.
Now we got to start all over again.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Exactly right. So a lot of things are completely up in the air at this point.
You know? Yes. And
including
more
this show.
Oh, is he still awake?
Yeah. He's awake now.
I was in Second Life playing.
Yes.
Because that's what I do.
I think we probably torn this one apart.
We are actually done. We're gonna wrap this one up right now.
Yeah.
If you would like to comment on our discussion of this episode, you feel free to send an email to babylonpodcast@gmail.com or call in a comment. That number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year before a major supporting character died.
We love you, Kosh, man. Don't ever go. We love you, Kosh.
Peace out. to our homeboy Kosh, who's gone beyond the rim. We'll see you next time on the other side of the gate.